Here I go, on my way to camp, he thought. I feel like a kid. I hate feeling like a kid.
She's a 1975 VW, Wainwright said, his voice booming from the driver's seat.
When no one else responded, Sam leaned forward from his seat in the third row.
What was that? The bus! She's from 1975, the same year the Finch sisters moved into the house on Kill Creek. The same year, I believe, Mr. Cole published two novels, At the End of the Tunnel and The Dark Before Dawn.
That's correct, Sebastian said, obviously a bit embarrassed by Wainwright's comment. Moore gave a sarcastic whistle. We get it. Sebastian has written a lot of books in his 100 years. Sebastian gave a good-natured chuckle.
Don't worry, Miss Moore. The Dark Before Dawn was complete shit.
And Tunnel? Moore asked.
Well, it was genius, of course, he said with a wink.
Sam leaned back, listening to the drone of the highway under the wheels. Daniel Slaughter sat beside him on the leather bench, his hands folded obediently in his lap. He was clad in an unremarkable green polo shirt. This was tucked into tan dockers and cinched with a brown leather belt, a little too tightly, Sam observed, based on the considerable bulge hanging over. Daniel's chubby arms were pale against the short sleeves of the shirt, his flesh the pinkish-gray of a dead fish's belly. The ride from the hotel in Kansas City had been a relatively quiet one, although Wainwright was determined to change that. Every few minutes he made a new attempt at mundane chit-chat, but so far every attempt had failed. For this, Sam was thankful. The internet tycoon's over-the-top introduction the night before had been exhausting, and Sam felt as though he had a hangover despite only having 3 beers at the hotel bar. For a few more miles, they rode in silence. Sam wished he had snagged the seat next to Sebastian, but Moore had claimed it first, leaving the back seat for Sam and Daniel. Now Sam stared at the back of their heads, Sebastian and Moore in the middle row, Wainwright and Kate up front, each off in their own little world. Coming to terms with their decisions to join Wainwright on his bizarre little field trip, Sam assumed.
Okay, time for a pop quiz, Wainwright announced, trying a new approach.
Oh, Christ, here we go, Sam grumbled under his breath. From the passenger side, Kate swung her camera around the edge of the seat and pointed it at the authors in the two back rows. The sunlight glinted off the wide-angle lens, giving it the illusion of having a slender reptilian pupil. Sam shifted uncomfortably in the camera's gaze. Wainwright tapped his copy of Phantoms of the Prairie resting on the dashboard. Sam could see its cover reflected in the glass of the windshield.
You were all given copies of the Adderdale book, so they shouldn't be too hard.
Wainwright kept his eyes on the road as he called back over his shoulder.
How many owners has the house had?
They responded with silence. Sam slid down in his seat. Enough with the game. No one wants to play. The lack of enthusiasm did not please Wainwright.
Anyone care to venture a guess?
Daniel glanced awkwardly at the others, realizing no one was going to participate.
Six, I think.
Wrong, Wainwright said flatly. There were 5.
He sighed.
Anyone know their names?
Again, there was no quick response.
Sam.
Wainwright adjusted the rearview mirror so that he could see Sam in the third row.
How about you?
Sam glanced up and found himself staring straight into Kate's lens. He shrugged and shook his head. I wouldn't know. Sorry. Wainwright's already deep voice dropped even lower. Any pretense of pleasantry was gone.
But you have the book. I gave it to you specifically for our trip.
Kate seemed to sense something coming, her body tensing, but she held the camera steady. He's pushing you, Sam told himself. He wants you to react. Sam met Wainwright's gaze in the mirror. It was late. I was tired. The leather steering wheel creaked as Wainwright tightened his grip.
What's the point of going to this house if you all know nothing about it?
There was anger in his voice now. Sam could see the back of the young man's jaw moving ever so slightly. He was clenching and unclenching his teeth.
Did no one bother to look at the book?
Wainwright snapped. Kate lowered the camera, pretending to busy herself with adjusting the settings.
I gave it a go, Sebastian announced. But I couldn't quite stomach Mr. Adderdell's assault on the English language. His use of exclamation marks was more terrifying than the description of the paranormal events they followed.
Moore swiveled on the bench to face the old man. You'd prefer he wrote in the self-consciously elegant style of the great Sebastian Cole?
Honestly, I would have preferred anything to Adderdell's prose. Even the self-consciously perverse style of T.C. Moore.
The comment caught Sam by surprise, and he snorted unexpectedly. Moore shot him what, even through her dark sunglasses, Sam could tell was meant to be an irritated look. Perhaps not entirely irritated. There was the tiniest hint of playfulness there. Despite her best attempts, she was beginning to warm to her companions.
I read it. I read the whole thing.
They all turned to look at Daniel, surprised by the sound of his voice. Sebastian cocked an eyebrow.
It's not your fault, Mr. Slaughter. Insomnia has been known to make people do irrational things.
It wasn't that. I wanted to read it. I wanted to know what you're getting us into.
And?
Wainwright asked, his voice deep and probing. He was nothing but a pair of eyes in the rearview mirror.
What am I getting you into?
Sam watched as Wainwright glanced over at Kate. The subtle hint of a smirk played at the corners of his lips. He likes that we're in the dark, Sam thought. Daniel shifted nervously.
Well, I mean, I didn't really believe a word of it. Seemed like a bunch of hooey to me.
I don't know what's scarier, Moore said. The fact that you read that entire awful book, or that you just said hooey with a straight face. Not everything has to be laced with profanity. I guess we just have two different styles, don't we, Mr. Slaughter? I say what people think, and you tell people what to think. Don't worry, you're not the first holy roller to think he knows better than everyone else.
Daniel's cheeks flushed red. I don't think I know better. I see writing as a way to teach a lesson through entertainment. You see it as an opportunity to glorify deviant behavior.
Okay, now, Sebastian said.
Moore ignored the old man. She had turned around in her seat to stare Daniel down with those dark cat-eye lenses. I simply encourage my readers to free themselves of the fabricated morality that is shoved down their throats every day by hypocritical priests and politicians. How? By telling teenage girls to cut themselves?
That's enough, Sebastian said louder.
Once again, Wainwright looked to Kate, and Sam could see that he was grinning. He gave a sharp nod, and Kate obeyed the order, whipping the camera up and instantly recording. He's enjoying this, hearing us tear each other apart. Moore continued. The only reason teenage girls would even think to harm themselves is because high and mighty pricks like you tell them that their own biology is sinful. They only need my release because of your repression. Maybe that's why my first book, a self-published book, sold more copies than an entire series of the church pamphlets you call novels.
Enough!
Sebastian's tone was that of a father pushed to the limit by his arguing kids.
Stop fighting over who is the better writer, or I'll turn this car around.
Wainwright called back in a faux, stern voice. He gave a low chuckle, amused by his own comment. Sam frowned. There's something off about him. One second he's ready to tear into us. The next he's joking like we're old friends.
What's on your mind, McGarver?
It was Moore looking back at him.
What? Sam asked, caught off guard. You look like you got something to say.
Sam watched Wainwright's eyes flash up to the rearview mirror. He waited for Sam's response.
I like your sunglasses, Sam told Moore.
She gave a surprisingly honest laugh, then nodded to Sam's left arm.
I like your ink,
but I'm more curious about what it's hiding.
Instinctively, Sam slid his right hand over his scars, doing his best to cover them. Sebastian sighed.
There, see? We can all get along.
In the rearview mirror, Wainwright's eyes were still on Sam.
What's your game? Sam wondered. Without warning, the bus swerved. Everyone gripped their seats as Wainwright swung the vehicle past the sign for Kill Creek Road and around the sharp curve of the exit ramp.
Sorry about that,
Wainwright said in that flat, deep voice. Soon the paved road gave way to gravel. Sam pressed his forehead to the cool glass of the window. The trees along the side of the road had already shed their leaves for the winter. Long, bare branches stretched over the road like a canopy of skeletal hands. Blackbirds, grackles perhaps, dotted the trees, their beady black eyes watching as the car rolled past. Every now and then one would give a shrill squawk at the intruders. You are not wanted here. You should turn back. Something flashed by on the side of the road, a chain-link gate covered in twisted green vines. A fence cut through the trees, running perpendicular to the road for about 50 feet before being swallowed into the shadows that stretched between ancient brown tree trunks. Wood planks rattled under the tires as the bus crossed a small, weather-beaten bridge. The dry bed of a stream snaked beneath them.
That's the creek, Wainwright said. Let's try this again. Anybody know why they call it Kill Creek?
Moore gave an irritated sigh. Sam barely made out the words she hissed.
Please be quiet.
In his book, Daniel said, Adderdale speculated that this land was the site of a massacre, possibly during the Civil War border battles between Kansas and Missouri.
I sincerely doubt the creek is named after a massacre, Sebastian interjected. Kill, or killa, is Middle Dutch for Greek. Early settlers probably used the word to describe this pitiful little stream. As more and more folks moved to the area, they must have thought Kill was the name of the creek, hence Kill Creek. Its name is nothing but a redundancy. Like saying the Rio Grande River, or the Sahara Desert.
Or Christian extremists, added Moore. Sam glanced over at Slaughter, expecting the tension in the bus to ratchet back up, but Slaughter chose to ignore Moore's jab. Leaning forward, Sam got a better look through the windshield. They were making their way up a long driveway of gray pebbles. On either side, tall grass waved in the breeze. It appeared as if it hadn't been cut in years. Through a break in the trees, he could see the dingy white wood of the house. Its crumbling brick chimney peeked over the top branches of the highest oak like a solitary horn. Except for the badly neglected Kill Creek Road, this house was completely cut off from the rest of the world.
Exactly how Wainwright wants us. All to himself.
He shook his head.
Stop. You're trying to make a mildly annoying situation into something worse.
But that's your M.O., isn't it, Sammy boy? He closed his eyes and tried to silence his mind. 2 minutes later, Wainwright brought the VW bus to a stop.
We're here,
he announced. Sam was the last one out. He slid the side door shut and turned to follow, but the rest of the group had not moved. They stood in a perfect stillness, staring up at the old house as if half expecting it to jump up and dance. It did not. It sat as a house should, motionless and silent, planted firmly on the secrets of its past. Had it not been for the size of the structure, Sam would have thought it was nothing special.
a folk Victorian farmhouse, mostly square in shape, with an angular porch wrapping around from the front door to the middle of the south wall. Several slender windows dotted the facade. The wood splintered on the sides where, Sam assumed, protective boards had been removed to make the place more inviting. It wasn't an ugly house. On the contrary, the simple architecture and rural surroundings should have made it a quaint little cottage. Except that it wasn't little. It was huge. So big, in fact, that the word monstrosity came to mind. At a mere 3 stories, the house must have been at least 6,000 square feet, maybe more. A good quarter of an acre had been cleared of trees to make room for the foundation and sprawling yard. One tree remained, an ancient, gnarled, 40-foot beech growing just to the right of the front steps. The grooves of its twisted trunk resembled an arm stripped of flesh, the muscles exposed, its long dead branches reaching upward like an arthritic claw.
"Who in God's name built this thing?"
Sebastian asked, breaking the silence. Wainwright had his dog-eared copy of Adderdell's book clutched in his hands like a Bible.
"A settler named Joshua Goodman built it in the 1850s. With his bare hands. Drove every nail. Raised every wall."
"How is that possible?" Sam asked. It seemed that no man, no matter how determined, could construct such an edifice all by himself. That's what it was. Not a house, but an edifice. Its very existence seemed impossible without the help of the supernatural.
"I doubt anyone had the chance to ask him. Goodman was murdered in 1863, the same night Quantrill and his men torched Lawrence."
Daniel took a few heavy steps forward, his eyes never leaving the house. "It wasn't just Goodman who died," Daniel explained. His voice was not distant. It was steady, authoritative, much like Sam's own voice during one of his lectures. "A freed slave named Alma Reed was also killed that night." Daniel motioned to that hideous tree in the front yard. "They strung her body up from one of those branches." Sebastian and Moore stood side by side and stared up at the twisted beech tree. The two couldn't have looked more different. A bulky wool coat draped over Sebastian's tall, frail body. Tight black jeans and an even tighter long-sleeve tee with a lace-up front clung to Moore, barely containing her breasts. Together they were the reluctant intersection of elegance and rebellion. Nearby, at the edge of the high tall grass, Kate was capturing the moment. The camera gripped in her hands as she monitored the shot on a flip-out LCD screen. Sam looked straight into the camera lens for no good reason, simply because it was there. He was not aware of making any particular expression, but Kate lowered the camera and stared at him peculiarly, her face suddenly grave. Sam watched as she leaned over to Wainwright and whispered something in his ear. Wainwright placed a hand lightly on Kate's waist and spoke to her in a low voice. Whatever Wainwright said, it had the desired effect. Kate's stark expression softened, and she nodded obediently, agreeing to some unknown pact. "They're up to something," Sam thought. "Both of them." From his right pocket, Wainwright produced a single key on a metal ring. He dangled it between 2 fingers. To the rest of the group, he said,
"Well then, shall we?"
The others followed Wainwright toward the front steps, but Sam did not move. "After you," Kate said, motioning for him to go before her. He studied her face for a moment, but she offered nothing more than a pleasant smile. "Please," she said. Sam fell in line. He noticed the Adderdell book now tucked into Wainwright's back pocket. Every few seconds, Wainwright reached back and touched it, just to make sure it was still there. They mounted the stairs to the porch. Thick, furry vines curled around the edges of the steps, twisting up the rickety balustrades of the porch's railing. Crossing to the front door, Wainwright tore away a tentacle-like length of vine that had wound its way up the doorframe and around the tarnished knob. He slid the key into the lock, paused briefly for dramatic effect, then gave it a hard turn. The bolt withdrew with a reverberating thunk. What happened next was too brief for any of them to mention. The house seemed to ripple from foundation to roof. For a split second, the tall grass surrounding the structure appeared to bow, and then it rose back up, tall and straight, like hundreds of thousands of obedient soldiers. A shudder ran through Sam, through Sebastian, through every single one of them. Wainwright put his hand on the doorknob. He paused again, turning back to the group. One by one, he met their gaze, the light catching in those slivers of purple in his irises.
"So, over the threshold we go," he said.
He turned the knob. The door swung slowly open, and Sam watched as Wainwright backed into the house, shadows enveloping him, that knowing smile stretching across his mask-like face. He wanted them to follow. Part 2. A Whisper Through the Wall. October 31st to November 1st. Upon first entering the house, I found there was one thing for which I was profoundly unprepared. An overwhelming silence. Nary a sound filled my ears. No clocks ticked, no boards creaked. Only the faint whisper of my own breath and that of Rachel at my side. "Is it always this quiet?" I asked her. Rachel smirked. "No," was all she said. And so began my tour of the house on Kill Creek. Dr. Malcolm Adudel, Phantoms of the Prairie. 10. 12:54 p.m. The four authors, Wainwright and Kate, all stood one step inside the front foyer, listening to the house and the air drifting invisibly through it. There was nothing particularly odd about entering the house. No drop in temperature, no feelings of being watched, no sudden sense of dread. There was only the slightest sensation of a change in barometric pressure, a fullness in their ears. It was so subtle, none of them mentioned it. And in less than a minute, it passed. For Daniel Slaughter, the most surprising thing about the house on Kill Creek was the warmth it exuded. The floor, planed and varnished by hand over a century ago, was an inconsistent pattern of maple and black walnut planks, some lighter, some darker, a collision of grains, of knots and rings, of varying lengths and widths. Yet the imperfections only added to the homey charm of the structure, and by the time the boards met the beautifully carved molding along each wall, everything was flush, everything was right. A wide federal staircase was set against the west wall, leading up to the second floor. With its square newel post and rounded balusters, the staircase was deceptively simple. But upon closer inspection, each newel featured meticulously carved notches, each baluster adorned with a tightly etched spiral. Some boards were cracked, some paint had peeled, and a fine layer of dust had settled over every surface. Still, the craftsmanship on display eclipsed any flaws. Joshua Goodman had made sure that every inch was a simple yet elegant labor of love. The sunlight drifting in through archways to the right and left was not so much reflected as it was absorbed by the wood and then projected out again in a brilliant golden glow. Daniel followed the sunlight across the room to a far wall on which a crucifix hung crookedly. It was simple, made from the same wood as the floor, no doubt carved by Goodman. Daniel crossed the foyer and adjusted the crucifix 20 or so degrees clockwise. "There we go." He heard more chortle and he closed his eyes. From the hill there came a loud rumble. They turned to see the devil above them. The Ancient One peered into their souls and learned their secrets. It would be back for them. Their lust would be their downfall. Let me guess. The Gospel of Paul? She asked. Actually, that's from the Book of Daniel, he corrected with a wink as he moved past her. Daniel noticed smiles on the faces of Sam and the frail Sebastian. He smiled himself. It's okay, Moore. I have enough faith for the both of us. Daniel glanced over and saw that Kate's camera was up. She had captured the exchange. Great. Just what they want for their big show, Daniel thought. Wainwright swiveled on worn black work boots to face the group.
Welcome to the house on Kill Creek. What do you say we have a look around?
Daniel Slaughter took in the house once more. He did not think it was a bad house. In fact, in that moment, he was sure that it welcomed him. They moved through the front foyer, passing beneath the arched doorway at their left.
Ah, Sebastian thought. Now this is a room after my own heart.
They were in a study. Large, dirty windows lined the west wall. Their smudged panes let in enough light, however, to make the room feel cheerful and inviting, despite the gloom of the overcast day. Two mahogany chairs sat at an angle, an ornate table between them. Built-in bookshelves, packed with books, lined the wall directly ahead.
All of the furniture belonged to the Finch sisters, Wainwright explained.
He carried his well-used copy of Phantoms of the Prairie in his right hand.
In their will, they stated that, even in the possession of the county, everything in the house was to remain as they left it, untouched.
Sebastian ran a finger over the spines of the books on the shelf. It did not matter to him what the titles were. They were books. They were filled with thoughts. Their relevance was debatable. He was sure some were exceptional, while others were the works of lesser minds. He was not above calling a book unreadable, but their literary merit wasn't important at this moment. They were words strung together to represent the firing of neurons and the transferring of information through synapses. They were human minds set into paper, and Sebastian loved every single one of them, even the ones he found disposable.
Like that blasted Adderdale book. He thought.
Yes, even the Adderdale book deserved to exist, because the man himself sat down and pounded keys until all of the clutter in his brain was carefully organized and displayed for others to experience.
This is why we do it,
Sebastian told himself as he looked down the row of leather-bound tomes.
To live on. To exist. When we stop existing. To be remembered.
It's a beautiful room. Sebastian turned away from the bookshelf. Daniel Slaughter was standing by one of the chairs, his hands in his pockets. He took in the space like a tourist with 10 free minutes to speedwalk through Notre Dame.
The Finch sisters loved this house,
Wainwright said.
His voice. I'll never get used to that. Booming, as if it is coming from a speaker pointed directly at my ear.
The others were talking. They were discussing the years in which Rebecca and Rachel Finch were alive, the time when both sisters roamed the rooms of this house. But Sebastian wasn't listening to them. They were a wall of noise. He thought of millions of words he had committed to paper. He thought of the countless ideas that had flitted through his mind like hummingbirds hovering over the buds of newly opened flowers. And he blinked the fog away. Sam walked through the swinging door that brought them to the kitchen. This is nicer than my damn house, he told himself. It was a spacious layout, a standard L-shaped room with dark walnut cabinets lining two of the walls. An enclosed porch could be seen through the French doors to their left, a wicker couch and chair surrounded by the shriveled brown corpses of long-neglected plants. At the center of the kitchen, the modern addition of an island floated in isolation directly in front of a deep farmhouse sink. The grout between the chipped white tiles had seen better days, but otherwise the room was in fine condition. As with the furniture, the appliances were from decades past. A four-burner stainless steel gas stove and a mismatched white 1950s-style refrigerator with a large metal handle. Like the foyer and library, the kitchen was bathed in warm afternoon sunlight. Moore stepped up next to Sam. She was still wearing her sunglasses. "It's a little odd, right?" she asked. Sam shook his head, confused. "What?" "How nice the house is. Isn't this place like 150 years old? She was right. With the exception of the dust and the chipped tiles and the musty hint of air trapped for too long, the house was immaculate. The pressure Sam felt when they first entered returned, pressing into his eardrums. He pictured himself sinking deeper and deeper into an increasingly dark ocean. Above was the light. Below was the impenetrable depths of a bottomless trench. He glanced around the kitchen. He could hear his brother yelling. He could hear his mother screaming. "The kitchen is the heart of the house," Sam thought. "It is a place of gathering, of conversation, of love. It should be," he corrected himself. But this house was not a place of love. It was a place of death. Goodman's hopes, his dreams, his love had been brutally taken from him. Wainwright opened the fridge door and a breath of frigid air wafted out.
"Even though we'll only be here for one night, we made sure the refrigerator was stocked," he told the group. "Water, soda, wine, beer, cold cuts, vegetables, fruit."
The cry of tired hinges made Moore jump. Daniel had opened the back door and was staring out at a line of stones dotting the yard. "What the hell, Slaughter?" Moore snapped. The large man motioned to the pathway that led from where he stood to a break in the trees. "Where's that go?"
"The well,"
Wainwright said matter-of-factly, as if the path could lead only one place.
"It's pretty overgrown, so watch yourself if you go back there. They told me the well was covered years ago, but please, don't go out for a stroll and end up at the bottom of it."
Sam noticed Wainwright's smirk, as if the thought of one of them falling in the well amused him.
"And this?"
They all turned to find Sebastian, with his hand resting lightly on a closed door several paces down from the stove.
"A pantry, I presume?"
Wainwright shook his head.
"Basement. No reason to go down there. Nothing but rats and our trusty generator. Besides, the basement only runs a third of the house. The rest is crawl space."
"That's odd," Daniel said. "Why not have a full basement?"
"Perhaps Mr. Goodman started to dig but broke through to somewhere else."
There was a sparkle in Sebastian's eyes.
"Perhaps he realized he had opened a doorway to a dark, empty place, and so he sealed it and hoped he had caught it quickly enough, that he had stopped it before the darkness could escape."
Daniel nodded quickly, anxious to get in on the game. "Yeah. Yeah, like he broke through to hell, and the sins of his past were coming to drag him down."
"Sure, if you want to be painfully literal about it,"
Sebastian said dryly. Moore smirked. "Or maybe, and I'm just riffing here, maybe he got sick of digging a fucking hole." Sebastian smiled.
"It's a bit far-fetched, but I suppose it could have happened that way."
"Probably a foundation thing," Sam managed. "Being this close to the creek, they probably get quite a bit of runoff. Back when the house was built, there were no sump pumps, so unless they wanted an in-ground swimming pool beneath the house, Goodman opted to cut the basement short. I bet the house still has a problem with water getting in during a heavy rain." "You read that in the Aderdale book?" Daniel asked. I thought you said you didn't. Sam shook his head. I grew up about 2 hours south of here. A lot of storms in Kansas. A lot of basements. And a lot of shitty contractors who don't build them right. Light glinted off glass. Sam turned to find Kate aiming her lens right at him. A wave of nausea suddenly hit Sam, and he closed his eyes.
I don't want to be here. I don't want to be in this kitchen.
He felt like he was losing his balance. He was going to fall. He quickly reached out and grabbed the edge of the counter to steady himself. The counter felt rounded and oddly cold. It was metal. Sam opened his eyes. He was not gripping the counter, but instead the stainless steel stove.
It looked so familiar. So much like the one in his mother's kitchen, where she kept the cast-iron skillet on the back left burner.
Sam flinched as if he had been burned.
Are you all right, Sam?
It was Sebastian. His voice was low so as not to involve the others. For a moment, Sam had no idea how to answer the old man's simple question. Then he nodded and said quietly,
Yeah, I'm fine.
What's the matter, McGarver? How's getting to you?
Wainwright asked with a smirk. Sam clenched his teeth. Just want to keep moving. Wainwright motioned through the next doorway.
Come on, then. There's more house to explore.
They all shuffled forward, following. Sam was the first one out. A narrow hallway ran along the south side of the Finch house. Moore followed the group as they moved in single file past a long row of windows on their left. There were no doors off this hall, only the entrance from which they had come, an archway that opened to the back of the foyer, and a doorway at the far end.
Head toward that, Wainwright told them.
Moore thought.
His voice. Everything he says sounds like a command. Not one of my favorite things.
The doorway brought them past a quick succession of joined rooms, a bathroom, a sewing room, a den, to a surprisingly large space at the house's west end. A colorful peacock print decorated an elegantly upholstered sofa, contrasted by the traditional plaid of two sitting chairs, all arranged around a chipped yet attractive brick fireplace. A sturdy oak table was placed near the windows at the front, providing a clear view of the porch and that hideously grotesque beech tree beyond.
Where those bastards hung Alma Reed.
She imagined she could hear the creak of the rope and the rippling of fabric as the breeze blew Alma's dress. She could almost see the faint outline of her lifeless body swinging gently outside the window.
So, here we are.
Wainwright said, clapping his hands loudly.
This is the main living room and our HQ, if you will. The place where we'll spend the majority of our time at the Finch House. There's a nice stack of wood out back left by the previous occupants, thank you very much, which will provide us with a fire this evening. The house, well, it tends to be rather cold.
Of course it does, Moore said. That's some classic haunted house bullshit right there, Wainwright.
Yes, surely you can do better than cold spots,
Sebastian added, his voice as crisp as the autumn air.
Just supplying the facts,
Wainwright's tone was even and assured. Moore touched the back of a chair. The living room. A thought drifted quickly through the dark expanse of her mind, and she snatched it up. The living room. A place that is alive. Moore had always hated the term living room for exactly that reason. It conjured up images of a family gathered to spend quality time with each other in some ridiculous Norman Rockwell wet dream. She knew some people were convinced this existed in their lives, but Moore refused to believe it. There were always secrets. Daddy is having an affair. Mommy is popping pills. Junior spends a little too much time torturing bugs in the driveway. And baby? Well, baby makes mistakes, doesn't she?
Baby runs off because she thinks she's in love. It's a shame Goodman only got to enjoy this place for such a short time, Daniel said. Moore gripped the back of the chair, digging her silver nails into the fabric. Come on. What did he really think was going to happen? They all turned to her.
What do you mean? Wainwright asked.
I mean Goodman was a white dude, shacking up with a black girl in the years before the Civil War. What did he think? That the murderous cocksuckers from the slave state next door were just going to let that happen? He loved her. It was Kate, staring at Moore over the barrel of her camera lens. The camera clicked as she snapped a still photograph. And it got them killed. What good is that? Moore asked. They couldn't help how they felt. Kate held her finger on the button and rattled off a burst of photos, all of Moore staring back at her. Maybe they knew that death was a possibility. Maybe it made their love stronger. Kate turned her head slightly to steal a glance at Wainwright. He was watching her with a strange sense of wonder. Baby thinks she's in love, Moore thought again. She clenched her fists. That's some bullshit. Death doesn't make love stronger. Death only makes things dead. The camera went rat-a-tat-tat as Kate fired off another burst. I think you have enough pictures of me, Moore said coldly. Kate lowered the camera. You're right. I got what I need. She switched the setting back to movie mode. The camera beeped softly, once again recording video. What's next? Daniel asked.
Wainwright motioned through the archway toward the foyer. Well, now's as good a time as any to bring in your bags. Then I'll show you to your rooms.
11. 1:28 p.m. Sam could feel his every move being watched. It's Kate. She stood several yards away, hip deep in the tall grass. She cradled her camera like a child, eyes on the LCD screen as she captured every moment in high def. They're fucking, Sam heard Moore say, as she lifted her bag from the back of the van.
Who?
Daniel asked, blanching at her vulgarity. Wainwright and the camera girl, Moore explained. She's that rich twat's woman, so quit eyeballing her tits.
I'm married, Daniel said.
And that stopped 100% of no one, Moore replied, shouldering her bag. On the porch of the house, tucked back into the shadows created by the overhang, Wainwright waited for them to retrieve their luggage. As always, the A. Dudell book was clasped in his hands.
What do you think he's really up to? Sam quietly asked the others.
Sebastian followed Sam's eyeline.
Who? Mr. Wainwright?
He's harmless.
Or as harmless as an arrogant billionaire's son can be.
They're both weird as shit, Moore said. 'Cause they're hiding something, Sam thought.
And then, almost immediately, he scolded himself.
You don't know that. Stop looking for problems where there aren't any. You'll drive yourself crazy.
Sam said aloud, You all saw how he reacted in the bus when he realized I hadn't read the book.
Maybe he just wants us to be as excited about this place as he is, Daniel suggested.
Moore leaned into the back of the bus for her bag.
Or maybe he secretly brought us all here to kill us.
He and his little Manson girl are going to torture us, murder us, and then upload the whole goddamn thing to the internet. He'll be the most famous name in horror by noon tomorrow. Sam glanced over at Kate, noticing for the first time the shotgun microphone mounted atop the camera and the earbud wire snaking up from the camera's headphone jack.
Did she hear that? Sam wondered.
Kate lowered her camera and gave a knowing smile. Sam followed the others across the foyer to the door of the elevator. Behind them, Kate stopped at the foot of the staircase.
I'll meet you up there,
she said, her charming southern twang competing with the clatter of the elevator's accordion door. And then she was gone, bounding up the stairs to the second floor. The rest of them crammed shoulder to shoulder into the tight confines of the elevator, their bags by their sides. Sam suddenly found it difficult to breathe.
Why are we taking the elevator? We barely have any luggage. Why does Wainwright want us in here?
Is this really necessary? He asked aloud. We're going up one story.
Rachel would have wheeled her sister into this elevator,
Wainwright said, as if this explained it.
It was Rebecca's only way to get around the house.
Sam pressed his back against the wall of the elevator. Wainwright reached for the control panel. In addition to the requisite door open and door close buttons, there were three more, one for each floor. Wainwright pressed the button marked 2. The elevator jolted violently as, somewhere in the shaft above, a cable was drawn over a pulley. Sam knew the thought was ridiculous, but he couldn't help thinking it.
He wants to kill us. He wants this to drop with all of us on board.
Daniel shifted in place, suddenly worried.
You had this thing looked at, right? To make sure it's still safe?
Moore tried to reposition herself around Daniel's bulk.
I don't think the elevator's the problem here, big guy. Maybe you should take the stairs.
It's safe,
Wainwright told them.
It offered very little reassurance.
The chain clicked above them as they began their surprisingly long journey to the second floor.
The elevator was the fastest way for Rebecca to get around the house. Not that she used it much. In the 2 years she lived here, her final years, Rebecca almost never left her bedroom on the third floor.
The elevator came to a shuddering stop. Wainwright pulled the accordion door open, revealing Kate, already there, focusing the wide-angle lens of her camera. Without looking up from her monitor, she stepped to the side, clearing the way for the group. There were 5 bedrooms on the second floor, all indistinguishable from the outside, each marked by a heavy wooden door. Wainwright walked backward as he led the group. Kate trailed behind.
Slaughter, this is you,
Wainwright said, pointing to the first door on the right.
You'll find everything you need for a comfortable night. A nice big bed, dresser for your clothes.
Daniel gave a little smile of appreciation and disappeared into his room. Wainwright turned back to the others.
His face. Sam thought. Why does it look like flesh draped over flesh?
With his hands tucked into the pockets of his jacket, Wainwright sauntered down to the next door, the first on the left.
Sebastian Cole.
Wainwright tapped the door lightly as if christening it. This time he did not wait for the named to enter the room. Instead, he gave a sigh, apparently bored with his own game.
Miss Moore.
You can all stop with the miss bullshit. I don't hear you saying mister when addressing everyone else.
Right, Wainwright said. Moore, the next door across the hall, that's you. And Sam, your next door neighbor's with Mr. Cole.
What about Kate? Moore asked. Where will the lovely lady be resting her head?
Kate and I are sharing the room at the end of the hall, Wainwright explained.
Moore gave a sharp laugh, like the thrust of a knife. Can't pass up the chance to squeeze the peach, eh?
I'm not biting, Moore.
Moore blinked, feigning innocence.
What's that supposed to mean?
Sam watched the two of them. They were strange animals that had never been introduced, and he had no idea which was the more dangerous one. Wainwright turned to face her.
I know you're looking for a fight. Let's just try to be polite, yeah? We're all civilized people.
Moore's eyes narrowed. Speak for yourself. And I didn't come here to be lectured.
No. You came here to plug your new project. The one you hope will make everyone forget you've been shot out of the Cutter movie.
How did you... Wainwright continued.
You all came here for similar reasons. You came because you know what I can do for you. You know how popular Rightwire is. But just because you're all here for selfish reasons doesn't mean we can't have a bloody good time.
And what about you? What are you here for? Sam asked. Wainwright smiled as warmly as his rubbery flesh would allow.
I'm here to geek the hell out with some of my heroes, mate.
The fuck you are, Sam thought. Moore gave an incredulous snort, seeming to sense Sam's suspicion.
I'm quite serious, Wainwright said. It's an absolute thrill to have you here. Four legends. One amazing night.
Five legends if you count the house, said Kate from behind the camera. They all turned to her. The budding filmmaker was unable to resist this perfect staging of faces. Her finger flipped the setting from video to still. Say boo, she said as the shutter clicked. Sebastian closed the bedroom door behind him, the latch snapping obediently into place. With a weary sigh, he set his suitcase on the floor and took the bedroom in. It was a fairly Spartan arrangement. A red and black patchwork quilt covered a four-poster bed. A streak of gold snaked its way through the quilt's pattern like arms of ivy along a fence. Flanking the bed were two dark oak nightstands. On the left nightstand was a single brass lamp, its shine long tarnished, its shade brittle with age. On the nightstand to the right, there was nothing but a fine layer of dust.
That's where Richard's reading glasses would have been, Sebastian thought.
He could still picture them, rectangular lenses in simple wire frames. The only adjoining room was a bathroom. The door was half open. From where he stood, Sebastian could see only a fraction of the space. Tiny white tiles covered the floor. They were clean and perfectly spaced, glowing in the early afternoon light. Sebastian placed his suitcase on the bed, running his fingers over the worn, well-traveled leather before popping open the latches. He took out the meticulously folded clothes, a pair of slacks, a white button-down shirt with thin blue stripes, a clean pair of black socks. Tomorrow's outfit. Tomorrow, when this self-indulgent stunt would be over. He placed the clothes in the empty top drawer of a nearby dresser. In the second drawer, he placed his pajamas, a cotton plaid top and drawstring pants. Old man pajamas, just like his father wore. His father, not even 70 years old, dressed in those same striped pajamas, his face slack, a rivulet of drool winding down his gray stubbled chin. Sebastian remembered the moment so clearly, reading his father the poems of W.S. Merwin. Sebastian could remember every single verse, every nod of his father's head, every drop of saliva from his lips. A man in his 60s shouldn't have been so sick, but there he was, detached from the world. The worst part had been his father's eyes, vacantly staring out into the great nothing, blind to his own son sitting before him.
That is horror, he thought. That's the true awfulness I hope to capture in my books.
Sebastian took a deep breath and centered himself. The only things left in the suitcase were his notebook, containing several pages of nearly undecipherable notes he had jotted down during the plane ride. His pens, down to three, the fourth left in his room at the hotel in Kansas City. His copy of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson, and a dop kit containing his toiletries. The toiletries, a toothbrush, travel-size Crest toothpaste tube, bar of soap, metal comb, and small vial of aspirin, would go in the bathroom. He was reaching for the dop kit like he had done 100 times before when, just like that, the fog returned. Sebastian sat gently down on the bed, his eyes moving quickly about but looking at nothing specific. Instead, he looked inward, searching his mind for any train of thought. It lasted only a moment, and then the dominoes fell, each more specific than the last. He was in a house, not his own. His residence was in New York, just outside of Ithaca. This was a house by a creek. What was its name? Kill, his mind shouted suddenly. The startling word brought a cover of cold sweat to his skin. Kill. It repeated over and over, kill, kill, Kill.
Kill Creek.
He said the name again.
Kill Creek. You're in the house on Kill Creek.
His hands were shaking. He closed his eyes and heard his heartbeat deep down in the hollow of his chest, an angry fist pounding ribs.
It's only a moment, he whispered to himself. You're fine.
He opened his eyes. His hands had stopped shaking. He locked in the moment.
You're at the house on Kill Creek. You're here for a publicity stunt. Your name is Sebastian Cole. You're a writer.
The bedroom was impossibly silent. Not a single sound from the hall or the nearby rooms. Nothing from outside, despite the thin barrier of the single-pane window.
The house is listening,
he thought, and immediately wondered where such a ridiculous notion had come from. Snatching up the dop kit, Sebastian pushed open the bathroom door the rest of the way and moved inside. He unzipped the dop kit and removed the assorted toiletries, placing them in the medicine cabinet above the pedestal sink. His toothbrush slid off the shelf. Sebastian saw it fall and bounce off the edge of the sink, but he could not catch it before it hit the floor. He bent down and picked the toothbrush up off the crooked, filthy tiles. The thought of using it now made Sebastian's throat tighten a bit. He froze, the toothbrush gripped tightly in his hand. The tiles had been clean when he first saw them. He was sure of it. They were white and straight. He stared down at the floor. It was exactly as it had been. Not a smudge, not a fleck of dirt, each white tile meticulously placed. Sebastian shoved the toothbrush into the medicine cabinet and slammed the door closed. On the outside was a mirror, a large smudge streaked across its surface. His reflection was an ambiguous blob floating in the air. He scolded himself for letting his imagination run wild. Of course the tiles were the same. There was nothing otherworldly about this house, but he was a writer. It was how his mind worked. Always looking for a story. He knew there was another reason why he had wanted to jump to the supernatural. If the rumors were to be believed, he was standing in one of the most haunted houses in the country. Yet, except for the Adderdale book, which Wainwright and Daniel treated so reverently, there were no documented occurrences, no unexplained phenomena recorded by giddy parapsychologists.
Except Adderdale. He's a parapsychologist.
He's a quack, Sebastian said aloud, suddenly embarrassed by the sound of his own voice.
Get a grip, old man. You're talking to yourself.
Sebastian rested his hands on either side of the sink and stared into the smudged mirror. The amorphous blob of his reflection hovered before him. He glanced down and frowned. The faucet was dripping. Droplets of discolored water slowly formed on its lip and fell straight into the open drain at the bottom of the basin. Sebastian tried tightening the handles, first the hot, then the cold. The drip only worsened, the droplets forming more quickly. Something was strange. What was it?
Think, old man.
The droplets. They made no sound as they fell. The trap, hidden within the pedestal, couldn't have been more than 2 feet below the drain. The water hitting the pipe should have made some kind of sound, no matter how faint. But there was nothing. Only silence. Sebastian leaned down, the vague impression of his reflection disappearing from the medicine cabinet mirror, replaced by the blurred image of the empty bathroom behind him. With his hands on the sides of the basin for support, he lowered his head into the sink, careful not to put his face in the path of the falling droplets. His left ear hovered inches away from the black hole of the drain. Without warning, the faucet gave an angry cough and spat out a thick brown substance that splattered the white bowl below. Sebastian cried out and flinched away, but not quickly enough. The brown liquid spattered his face.
It's shit, he thought in disgust. Actual shit! You'll smell like this soon, old man, sitting in a nursing home and filling your diaper for some poor nurse to change.
He swiped at his face, smearing the liquid across his cheek. He held his fingers to his nose and sniffed. The brown liquid was not what he feared it was, although its scent was unpleasant, conjuring up images of things decomposing in darkness. He watched as the water from the faucet dripped brown for a few seconds, then became clear.